Dear students of my course, welcome at the Network Science course. For starting the course, the first lecture, please open the PhD SEM 1 PowerPoint file, and you will see the title at the first slide, Networks and Stability. And this will be part one, which is the rationale of networks in the frame of human cognition, their definition, and two important aspects of their topology, the small word network and the scale-free network. So now you should reach slide two, which has the title Science and Human Cognition. Now, if we are speaking cognition, first everyday cognition comes into mind, which is the simple experience taking when you, for example, touch an oven and you recognize when you are a little child that it's hot, and you recognize that you will never touch an oven directly again in your life. So these the tiny moments of our lives are maybe called as everyday cognition, and these are actually representing details of the details of the world which is around us. Now the second level, and you may touch your forward button now to see it, is artistic cognition, which is the details of the totality of the world. What do I mean under that? When an artist is thinking about the world, it is thinking about the world generally. So it is thinking, usually, it is thinking about the totality of the world, but the artist can reflect this totality of the world in his or her current perspective, current subjective perspective, which is bound to the personality of the artist, and it is bound to that particular moment when the artist was making that piece of art or rehearsing or playing that particular recording as a musician or contributing to art in any other ways. Now, the third level of human cognition is scientific cognition, or cognition which we mainly talking about at this lecture or generally in lectures, which is the totality of the details of the world. Science is about the details. Science would like to know something very much into details, very, very perfectly. But by nature, this cannot be the full world, but this should be, and it is usually, a very tiny, tiny piece of the world, which is in the focus of the scientific adventure, which is in the focus of the scientific inquiry. And this is what our experiments are about, and this is what scientific thinking is about. So it's always grabbing only a tiny piece of the totality, but it is trying to give a kind of full perspective, a kind of full account about that tiny piece of the totality which we are talking about. Let me give you an example. When we are measuring the blood pressure of mice, of a mouse, an experimental mouse, then we are thinking about an experiment, perhaps, that we give a certain drug to this mouse, and then we are measuring the difference in the blood pressure. Now, realize at such an experiment or at such an inquiry that this is a tiny piece of the world. This is only the blood pressure, and that mouse has many, many other, thousands of many other characters, features, which are changing by administering that particular drug. And we are adding only one drug to the mouse, and we are trying to make all the other conditions of his or her life the same. This is the principal character of any scientific experiment, that you are changing only one parameter, but you are fixing all the other parameters, or you are hoping that you are fixing all the other parameters. Now, realize that this is a double reduction of the millions of the of the possible parameters, first you are reducing all the changes in the life of the mouse to the administration of the drug. Second, you are measuring only the blood pressure of the mouse, and you are not doing anything else. This is the rationale of any scientific experiment. So all scientific experiments are measuring actually the totality of the detail, of a particular detail of the world. Now, if someone is actually interested in the totality of the world, so all aspects of the whole world at the same time, that can be, that is possible by human cognition, but that can be approached only by spiritual cognition, which is nothing, which is going beyond science and going beyond art and going beyond everyday cognition as well. So actually, when we are talking about network science, then we are expanding a little bit the bona fide, the regular scientific thinking, towards the artistic condition, cognition, and towards the spiritual cognition as well, because we are speaking about complex systems, and complex systems cannot be reduced only to one parameter or one particular change in their life. Now, in the second slide, you are seeing that great scientific results, this is the title, are often surprisingly simple and beautiful. I am just giving you an example or a detail of the conversation between Heisenberg and Einstein, Albert Einstein, and they actually were talking to each other, and they were recognizing that if nature leads us to mathematical forms of great simplicity and beauty, we cannot help thinking that they are true, reveal a genuine feature of nature. You must have felt this too, they said, the almost frightening simplicity and wholeness of relationships which nature suddenly spreads out before us, and for which none of us was at in the least prepared. Science, when it comes to its core, when it comes to its essence, it's becoming very simple. Great scientific statements are absolutely simple, are particularly simple. Now, this is actually a surprise, and this was very much stated by Einstein and Heisenberg, two great minds of the 20th century, because this is a surprise. I mean, science should be very complex and should be very complicated, and scientific language is almost understandable, but believe me, the greatest scientific results are surprisingly simple. So there are simple principles which are building up our nature, and actually network science was very lucky to discover some of this very simple organizing rules of nature. And this course, this whole network science course that I am giving to you, is about these rules, these simple general rules of organizing complex systems, which were revealed to us by network science. Now, the next slide is giving you a quotation from Albert Einstein, who said that if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. So scientific thinking is actually a long process. Many scientific minds are thinking about a certain scientific problem for not only one day, for not only one week or one month or one year, but for several decades, for 40 years, 40 consecutive years. In my research group, actually, in my network science group, there are several problems on which we are thinking for 25 or 20 years, like groups, for example, module formation of networks, which we will touch at this course later on. So until you cannot explain it simply, I am completely agreeing with Albert Einstein, you haven't understood it well enough. So how can we reach simplicity? This is the next slide. We are not talking about the donut. we are not talking about what usually people are talking about, but we are talking about the hole in the middle of the donut. And if you touch the screen or your forward button once more, you can reach the quotation from Murray Gell-Mann, who was a Nobel laureate, and he said that I was always focusing on the hole and not on the donut. And the understanding, the meaning of it is that if you are focusing your thinking about those points of life which have been known before, that's futile, that's not usable for scientific thinking, because for scientific thinking you must focus on the missing part, on the hole in the donut, on the missing part which hasn't been discovered yet. Which is somewhere in the future, which is the adjacent possible, as Stuart Kaufman, founding father of our field in network science or complex science, was saying it about 50 years ago. So you should search for novelty. You shouldn't look just for utility, just for the simplicity of known things. This is the essence of science. So to see the hole, this is the next slide, in the middle of the donut, you need to know the donut first. So you cannot spare your studies, what you are doing right now at the university or at any other level later on, PhD level for example, because you have to learn first what is existing. You have to learn first the donut. And then you will see the hole in the middle of the donut. Without learning the donut, without knowing the donut, you will never see the hole in the middle. So this is very essential. This is actually a major reason, or major rationale, or major importance or cause of your current studies. If you would like to understand or discover anything novelty in life, first you have to know life. And this is very important. Now I'm just giving you a view of you to you as an example of my own life, the view of life of the PhD student. And as you can see on the slide, it is a whole cycle, a whole circle, and it is representing his or her world, whole world. So for a PhD student, his or her scientific project, which is a very tiny project, very little project, it's his or her whole world. When you are becoming a postdoc, then you start to realize that your own world, your own scientific project, is only part of the world, part of the large world. And you perhaps realize that it's one-to-one. So in your right hand there is your project, and in your left hand there is the rest of the world, and your task as a postdoctoral student to combine these two. And this is quite general. By the time you reach the professorial level, where I am now for a while, for 20 years or more than 20 years, then you realize that your own work, your own studies, your own whole life, your whole achievement in your life is a tiny, tiny, tiny piece, is a neglectable piece of the whole world. And the whole world is great. And your contribution is minor. So this humility is actually the entry of your success. So to be successful in your life, you should not be very proud of yourself, but should be very humble about your achievements and about your contribution. And that's what is giving you the understanding of the rest of the world, what is giving you the understanding of the wholeness of the world, of the beauty of the world which is around you. So again, I'm giving you in the next slide a quotation from Albert Einstein, who made everything very simple. So he said that your ego is actually inversely related to your knowledge. So when your knowledge is growing, then your ego is shrinking, is getting more and more little. And if your humbleness is tiny, if your ego is large, then your knowledge will be small. So the more the knowledge, lesser the ego, lesser the knowledge, more the ego, told Albert Einstein, and I'm completely agreeing with him. So at the next slide, now we got to network science, so the course which we are talking about right now, and we are placing actually network science into human cognition. And as you may remember, there are four ways of human cognition: arts, everyday cognition, science, and spiritual cognition. And network science is somewhere at the middle of all these ways of human cognitions. Obviously, it is coming from science, because it's part of science. It is a way to do science. But it is a kind of integrated science. So it is expanding science into the other types of human cognition, like arts, like spiritual cognition, and like everyday cognition. This is a very unique feature of network science, and this is what is making network science a very fruitful human approach and a very fruitful human enterprise. Now, in the next slide, I am quoting you another Nobel laureate, who is Sidney Brenner. And when he was getting his Nobel Prize, it was several years ago already, he was saying that we are drowning, we are suffocating in a sea of data and starving of knowledge, starving for knowledge. Now, this is a very typical situation of these days. And this is actually a very typical situation of the last like 20 or 30 years in science, that science have uncovered a vast knowledge of data, a vast amount of data. But we have to understand this vast amount of data about our human body as well, about our medical condition as well. And this data explosion made to think us, or forced to think us, about novel approaches, how to handle this data. And one of these approaches is actually network science. And the reason of it, or the benefit of it, about many, many other benefits, is that we have a right hemisphere dominance. We have two hemispheres in our brain, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. It is obviously not exactly the left side of your brain and the right side of your brain. It is kind of scattered in the brain. But the left hemisphere type of thinking is an analytic type of thinking, is a thinking which is about facts, which is about equations, which is about the scientific approach. The right hemisphere type of thinking is a kind of visual image, a kind of pattern recognition, a kind of emotional recognition, and actually the left type of thinking is trying to understand data piece by piece. The right type of thinking is trying to look for patterns in the data, trying to look for the meaning of the data. And this is what we need when we have much of data, when we have a flood of data, when we have too many data around us, which we have right now in our life. So you need methodologies which help you actually to understand these vast amount of data around us, and network science is one of them. And in the next slide, you are seeing a network which is looking like a broccoli or a cauliflower, and the title is New Synthesis Networks. And actually, networks are giving you both a kind of mathematical, logical, and logical understanding, and also a kind of visual understanding, a kind of complexity, wholeness understanding, a kind of pattern recognition understanding, for example, by visualizing networks. And I will give you, not in this lecture, but in a lecture which will be later on, an example of a visualization methodology which was figured out in our own scientific group. We call it ENTOPT, entropy optimization method. And that visualization technology of networks is giving you a visual image of groups, of modules in networks. And such visual images of networks are giving you a particular way to understand the patterns behind the data, the patterns which are giving you a meaning of your data, and the meaning of the behavior of the complex systems. So the traditional view in the next slide is giving you one cause and one effect. And this is, again, a Nobel laureate, Paul Ehrlich, major magic bullet. And this magic bullet was the principle that there can be, that you can find certain drugs which are curing certain symptoms. And there is one symptom in the simplified case, like a headache, for example. And there is one drug which you take against your headache. And that drug is curing your headache, is finishing, completing your headache. So this was the drug designing principle 100 years ago. But things have changed, as I mentioned before, and we have now 100 causes and 100 effects, if not 10,000 or millions or billions of causes and billions of effects. And this is a very daunting feature, and it's a very daunting situation. So we have to figure out the major causes, those few, and the major effects, those few, because our mind is very limited. The working capacity, the working memory of our brain is very much limited. It is limited to 6 to 8 pieces of information at the same time. So you have to reduce things, the complexity of your world around you, to 6 to 8 pieces of information maximum. Better to reduce it to 1 or 2 pieces of information. So this is what we call, actually, the next slide, Occam's razor, which was named after William of Ockham, who was a monk in the 13th or 14th century, and he was designing the major scientific principle, which is to make the things as simple as possible, to reduce the complexity of life around us, because at that time the people like William of Ockham have already discovered for themselves the complexity of life. And they also understood that if you would like to understand this complexity of life in a scientific way, then you have to reduce it. Then you have to reduce it to simple facts, one simple cause and one simple effect. And that's what we called Occam's razor. Now, in the next slide, I am giving you an expansion, a modern way of understanding of Occam's razor, and that is we are calling Einstein's razor, Albert Einstein's razor. And this was told first time by Albert Einstein in his Herbert Spencer lecture at 1933, so almost 100 years ago. So Albert Einstein told, I'm quoting it from the slide, that the supreme goal of all theory is to make the irreducible basic elements as simple and as few as possible. But then, this is Occam's razor so far, so nothing new. Now here comes the new part, the second part of this quotation. Without having to surrender the adequate representation of a single datum of experience. So Albert Einstein recognized, researching complex systems, that if you would like to make a correct account, even scientifically, about a complex system, then you cannot reduce the number of data which are describing the complex system beyond a certain extent. If you are reusing the data describing a complex system beyond a certain extent, which means that, for example, your complex system is large enough, and therefore there are only 100 pieces or 1,000 pieces of information which are describing that complex system correctly at that very time. Then, if you are reusing your experimentation, your experience beyond this, and you are experimenting only or experiencing only one parameter of that complex system or two parameters, that is not enough to describe the whole complex system. So there is somewhere an optimum between Occam's razor, which are reducing the complex life around us to one or two basic principles, and the description of the complexity of the life, which is by a billion data, by a billion parameters. And science is actually required to find this optimum between the billion, which we cannot understand in our mind, by our mind, and between the two, or between the one, which is too small, too little, too few to describe a complex system. And this is actually not already a science, but it is getting to be an art, to understand, to realize, where is this optimum? It is at 5 parameters, or it is at 10 parameters, or it is at 20 parameters. You don't know it at the very beginning. You have to experience your situation scientifically, and then you will have an understanding, a vision, an emotion about what is getting to be enough for the description of that complex system. And that is not only one data. So we have reached the definition of networks. This is the next slide, which is actually the starting of our course. After the preliminary remarks so far. So what is the definition of networks? We have nodes in the networks, which are parts of the system, which have common properties. Think about yourself as a social community, for example, as a network, as a social network, and then you will realize that you yourself are a node in this complex system, and each of your fellows, your friends, your family members are also nodes of this complex system. And there are edges of the network, which are actually the connections of the nodes. So between two persons, a social connection is actually an edge of the social network, of the social system. So these edges can be actually weighted or directed or signed, which is the positive or the negative edge. So whether you are liking that particular person or you are hating that particular person, that protein is activating the neighboring protein or that protein is inhibiting the neighboring protein, or these edges can be colored, which means that there are several types of edges between two nodes, two persons, for example, and that is actually life. Because if you are thinking about an edge that you made a telephone call to someone, you have friends whom you haven't made telephone calls for a while because you are exchanging emails. Now, if an edge is a telephone call and another edge is an email, then you have two colors of the edges, telephone call type of edge and an email type of edge. And both types of edges are characterizing your connection with that particular person. And many other types of edges are also characterizing it. Personal connection, a joint meeting, for example, or other ways of connecting that particular person. And this can be all counted as a color of an edge. Now, let me give you a little bit of understanding how difficult network science is by giving you an understanding of the weights of the edge. So what is a weight of the edge? The weight of an edge is actually the strength of the edge. If that edge is very populated, very probable, very likely, very much experienced, very frequently experienced, then we are calling it a high weight edge. If that is not very likely, not very probable, experienced very rarely, then we are calling it a low weight edge. Now, just thinking about a social connection, your connection with a friend of yours, and try to measure it or try to reduce it to a mathematical number. Now, the question arises, your best friend is your best friend. Your second best friend is your second best friend. How much better your best friend is than your second best friend? Your best friend is twice better friend of yours as your second best friend, or third time or three times better friend of yours as your second best friend. Now, if you are starting to think about this in this way, and this is the scientific way, this is the numerical way, the mathematical way, then you try to understand, you are starting to understand that this is very difficult. Think about it, that social scientists are measuring social connections as an edge weight by measuring, for example, the number of telephone calls, as I mentioned it before. But the number of telephone calls is only a part of the measure. It is also important how long were you speaking to your friend. Now, okay, then it is also important what have you told to your friend. And it is also important what was the emotional reaction of your friend to this. If you told many things to your friend, but there was absolutely no emotional reaction, no positive or no negative reactions, then actually it was a very superficial chat. And it was not a deep, friendly discussion. So you have to measure several things now at the same time. Now, and we haven't reached the complexity of a friendship because we haven't reached the point that how many times have you bought a birthday present to your friend in the last 10 years? 10 times or only 5 times? Or how many times it was a very much sought present, so a very special present to the friend, or it was just a general present, a bottle of wine or some biscuits or some sweets or something what is an everyday idea. How much your friend was liking this present, what was the depths of the emotional reaction to this present, to this birthday present. Now, this is not the end of the story, because we may continue the dimensions of your friendship. How many times have you slept in the apartment of your friend in the last year? One time, zero time, 100 times, 330, 65 times each night. This is representing a different level of the friendship or the connection, relationship. Now, the very difficult part comes if you would like to reuse all of this, and I just gave you three examples only, to a single number, then what do you say? One birthday present is how many telephone calls? And how many telephone calls are equaling one night slept at your friend's apartment? Now, I don't think you can give an easy answer to this. So now you start to understand that giving a simple weight of a simple edge in a network is not an easy task. And I would like to make a very important caution message here, that there is an extreme data reduction here. And you have to observe this always when you are thinking about networks. And this is based on background knowledge. Now, this is very important because this is giving you the warning that unless someone who is talking to you about a network cannot define precisely enough the nodes, the parts of the complex system, and the edges, the connections between the nodes, including the weights, the directions, and signs and colors of the edges, then this whole network is not defined enough. Then this whole network is actually meaning nothing. So I would like to encourage you to look for this definition all the time before you start to think about a network. You have to precisely define the network, its nodes and its edges, and then you may understand the network science and you may start to apply those principles and those features, what I will talk about at this course. So the next slide is having the title that networks break conceptual barriers, and I just would like to give you a flavor, a clue, an idea about that networks have general properties. So there are very simple principles. Remember Albert Einstein, that these are the most important principles of science or human cognition. So there are very simple principles which can characterize networks. And we will touch two of these small important principles, the smallwordness and the Hobbes, the scale-free degree distribution at this lecture. And but there are many more, like the nested hierarchy or the stabilization by weak links. So this generality of network properties give you or offers to you a judgment of importance of your ideas, what you gained about networks, and also an innovation transfer about across different layers of complexity. Because if you reached a certain conclusion, which is important enough, then you have to be able to apply this conclusion not only to your particular network, like a social network, for example, but other networks as well, like a signaling network of proteins, or an amino acid network of a single protein structure, or other networks around you, like the train transportation network, or the public transportation network, or many other networks. So usually the most important features of network science or networks are particularly general, and this is actually the beauty, but also this is the difficulty of network science. So the next slide is giving you an account about the Milgram experiment, which was made by Stanley Milgram approximately, it is almost 50 years ago. And it had a very peculiar and important design in social network analysis. And it had 96 participants from Nebraska. And if you are from the United States, then you know that Nebraska is a state of the United States, which is not particularly centrally positioned state of the United States. I am sorry if you are coming from Nebraska, don't feel insulted by this, but this is true. So 96 participants from Nebraska, actually it could be any other states of the United States, were asked to send a letter to a target person in Boston, and the restriction was that they haven't known the postal address of the target person, so it was not that easy that you just mailed the letter by the U.S. Postal Service. But they had to figure out a chain of friends reaching the target person in Boston. Obviously, they were given the name of the target person in Boston. This is important. And they were given some features of the target person in Boston. And what was the very surprising outcome of this experiment? That actually 18 letter chains out of the 96 participants have actually reached this target person, and the friends whom you could send this letter asking the friend to forward a person who might know this target person in Boston, you have to know by a first name basis, and if you are coming from an Anglo-Saxon country, you know that this is a very rather close type of friendship, or it is actually a friendship between two people in the English speaking world. So what had happened actually? These people have mailed or have sent or given this letter to their friends. Obviously, there was zero chance that they know this target person in Boston as a friend of theirs in Nebraska, or I mean, if you are just selecting a single person from the 200 million inhabitants or more in the United States, then it has zero chances that another person randomly selected in a very different state of the United States region will know this person personally as a friend. So there was zero occasions when this letter could be sent directly to this person in Boston. However, these people were trying to focus this target, so they were trying to send it to a friend of theirs in Boston, because that friend may know this person in Boston already. I mean, if you are living in Boston by any chance, then you know that Boston is a relatively large city. So, well, it has quite a little probability that you will know another person selected randomly in Boston. But if you know that particular person is a doctor at a certain hospital in Boston and you are living in Boston, then you may know another person from that hospital, or you may know a doctor in Boston, and then you may send this letter to your friend who is a doctor in Boston. Now, if you are a doctor in Boston, then to know another doctor in Boston that is starting to have a pretty high chance. Or if you don't know that doctor personally, then you may know a doctor who is working at the same place as that particular doctor in Boston. So you may send this letter to your friend who is a different doctor working at the same place. Now, if you are a doctor working in Boston at a certain place, then it is almost having 100% of chance that you are knowing another doctor who is working at the same place. So by this, in four steps, you could reduce your friendship or the letter targeting to that particular figure who is a doctor in Boston working at the Massachusetts Hospital, for example, at the surgery department, for example. Now you may understand that we have a connection structure in the social networks which are connecting us very tightly, actually. And this is the take-home message of the Milgram experiment, which was characterized by the 6 degrees of separation. This is a famous kind of proverbial statement in the United States or in the English countries. So this means that you are 6 friends away, generally, or as an average, from any persons in the United States or in the world. If you are examining Facebook, actually, then you are only, the average is only 4, or even less than 4. And actually, this was first described by Friedrich Korinti, who was a Hungarian writer, almost 100 years ago, in 1929. And Friedrich Korinti was writing about a person, and he was writing about a social game which was played in the social circles, in the high level of social circles in Hungary at that time, 100 years ago. And the game was the following: you would like to ask a favor from the king of Sweden. For example, that was a target person. This was the same way of targeting of a person, like a doctor in Boston at the Massachusetts Hospital at the surgery department. The king of Sweden is a very well-defined person, or the queen of Sweden. At that time, it was a king of Sweden. And I think right now is also a king of Sweden. How can you reach the king of Sweden? You don't know, most probably, the king of Sweden personally. Now, a way to reach the king of Sweden from Hungary 100 years ago was to know that the king of Sweden at the time was actually a very very ardent, very, very fluent, frequent tennis player. So he was very fond of tennis playing. And therefore, if you know a very famous tennis player, then it might be actually happening that very famous tennis player was playing tennis with the Swedish king already, because obviously if the Swedish king is inviting a famous tennis player and paying all the expenses to play a game with the Swedish king, then the tennis player will not refuse it. But the Swedish king is not inviting unfamous, pretty badly paying tennis players, because the Swedish king at the time was a very good tennis player himself. So he was inviting only the most famous tennis players of the world. So the task is to know a famous tennis player of the world. Now, you might not know a famous tennis player of the world by yourself, but you may know a person who is very good in tennis by yourself. And that person might know the famous tennis player of the world, who might know the Swedish king. So this is actually that simple enough. Try to think about a chain of friends reaching the Pope, Pope Francis. If you know someone in the Catholic Church who is high enough, then that person might know a bishop, or might even know a cardinal. And if that person is knowing a cardinal, then the cardinal must know Pope Francis. So actually, you reached Pope Francis by two or three connections. So Pope Francis or the Swedish king or famous people actually are very close to you, but even non-famous people are very close to you. So the next slide is giving you an account of, about repeated Milgram experiments. And these repeatedly done experiments showed that there are very few connections between 60,000 participants or 500,000 US participants or 18 million participants. And actually, those messages which were sent by these many people reached very easily the final target. Now, the next slide is giving you the expansion of the small world concept, because we call small worldness of this property of the networks. And this was done by Duncan Watts and Steve Strogatz about more than 20 years ago in 1998. And they discovered actually that this small worldness is not only true to social networks, like the film actor collaboration network, but this is also true to the C. elegans neuronal network and to the US power grid. Now, this was a very great surprise. How come that these networks, which are so different from each other, are behaving so simply, uniformly? So there is a very small characteristic path length in these networks, which is growing by the logarithm of the number of elements, number of nodes of these networks. And this is true for all networks, actually, in the world. So this is actually a very important and very surprising statement, and this is actually giving you a general understanding of the general principles building the networks. Now, in the next slide, I am giving you some warning messages that weighted and directed small worlds can behave differently, or it cannot be such an easy way to understand the small worldness, but actually small worldness can be defined to these networks as well, and it can be understood to these networks as well. Now, the next and last important feature of networks, which is general, is the scale-free degree distribution, which was discovered by two people of Hungarian origin, László Albert Barabási and Réka Albert, and it was also more than 20 years ago, in 1999. And this is actually giving you an understanding of the degree distribution of the network. Now, what is the degree? The degree of the number of the neighbors of the network. And what is the degree distribution? It is the probability of how large the degree of those particular nodes is. So there are certain nodes which have only one degree, they have one neighbor, but there are many, many, many more nodes which have more than one neighbors, two neighbors, three neighbors, four neighbors, and so on. So this degree distribution, which is the scale-free degree distribution, is giving you the fact, the general feature of networks, that if you have 10 times larger degree, so you have not only 10 neighbors, but you have 100 neighbors, then the probability that you have it is 10 times less. Now, this is giving you the very important consequence that there are hubs in the network. What are hubs? Hubs are nodes of the networks which have a large number of degrees, which is have a large number of neighbors. So hubs are nodes of the networks, persons in the social network, for example, who have 1,000 neighbors. I am having two Facebook accounts, and this is not because I am chatting by myself or liking my own posts in the Facebook, but this is because Facebook is closing your account if you have 5,000 connections at Facebook. So I reached this level of 5,000 connections approximately 8 years ago. So I had to close, or I had to finish my first account, and I had to open a second account because I have now 8,000 connections at Facebook, or even more. Fortunately, I haven't reached 10,000 connections, because then I have to close my second account and I should reach or open a third account at Facebook. But this is high enough. The scale-free degree distribution is giving you an understanding that you have these particular members as well, very rarely, in your network, in your social network, and any of your networks, which have a very high number of neighbors, and that the probability of such nodes in the network is not zero. Think about the neighbors of a prime minister, or the president of the United States, or the Pope, or the Queen of England. I mean, these people know very many people, not 10,000 people, but many, many more people actually in their whole life. So there are persons in our social network who have many, countless number of connections. And the probability of such a person is not zero. So this is actually what is given by the scale-free degree distribution, that 10 times higher number of connections is having a 10 times lower probability. And such a simple distribution of degree is very characteristic to networks of different types. And the next slide, I'm giving you a different high number of networks, including for example, the Louis flights in the middle of the network, that is that map type, map representation, and that is giving you the passes of a mole. The mole is an animal which is living beyond the Earth and digging holes beyond the Earth, below the Earth, below the Earth. So the mole is digging these holes. Now this is the map of the holes of the pass which were dug by a mole, by a certain mole rat below the Earth. And you can actually measure how many straight passes are there in this network, and you will see a scale-free degree distribution, which means that in most of the cases, the mole is changing directions as he or she is digging the pass. Why he is doing that? Because he is not finding straight, forwardly positioned insects one by one and eating them one by one and digging to the same directions in all his life. If insects were placed below the Earth, in a straight line, one by one, in an infinite distance, then the mole shouldn't change his or her direction ever in his life or her life, but digging the same path straight away to eternity. But this is not likely to happen. After a while, the insects are finished at that particular straight line, one after the other. So the mole has to change direction, finding other insects. And if he or she doesn't find that insect by changing direction, he's changing direction again. And in the most time, he or she is not finding insects in the neighborhood, so he or she has to change directions many times. But quite sometimes, he's finding two insects in a straight line. And that is giving him or her a straight pass at that certain direction. So this is giving you an idea about the life of the mole. But this scale-free distribution can be true to buildings like factors or architecture or the town size or sexual connections or earthquakes or many other ways of human life or life in nature. This type of distribution is true. Why I'm giving you just one more example, which is the fractality of the degree distribution, and you see a furniture in the top slide, and you see an image of building blocks in the bottom slide, and you see in the top slide that it is a little bit not beautiful, because why is it so? Because there are so many tiny details on this slide. There might be less details there, and in that case it might be perhaps more beautiful. In the bottom slide, it is not beautiful either. It is ugly, actually. Why is it so? Because you have only two measures at this bottom slide: the measure of the house and the measure of the window, and nothing else. And there are only two dimensions in the bottom slide, while on the top slide there are too many dimensions. There is the size of the bed, or the size of the furniture, but also the size of the tiny illustration or tiny pieces of encarvings in the furniture, or their own tiny pieces. So there are too many details on the top slides, and there are too few details on the bottom slide. So this carefree distribution is just in the middle. It's just giving you the beauty of the nature, what is usually happening in nature. And on the next slide, I am giving you some expansion and dangers of scale-free degree distribution. It must span many scales, because if you are having only 10 neighbors and 100 neighbors, it is not enough to establish a scale-free degree distribution. You have to have certain nodes which have 1,000 neighbors, and perhaps one node which has 10,000 neighbors as well. And you have to be very cautious, because a single line can be fitted to many curves. So this may not be a scale-free distribution, but this may be another type of distribution, and so on. So there are many dangers establishing this degree distribution, but this can be still a fairly general feature of networks. Now, what is the reason behind this generality of scale-free distributions? And I'm giving you some ideas. There is a preferential attachment, which was the original idea by Laszlo Barabási, and this is giving you the idea that if there is the first member of the network, then the second member, the second node of the network, can attach to this first node, and the third node can attach to the second and the first node. So the probability that the first node will have two attachments is two times higher than the second node. And if you are the hundreds node, then you have much less probability to have another attachment than the first node, because the first node had a probability for attachment for a neighbor when the second node was joining this neighbor, when the third node was joining this neighbor, when the fourth node was joining this neighbor, and so on and so on and so on. So this is like the usual games when we call it pilot games. Then you are paying a certain amount of money, and that is a common kind of set of money, and you are giving or taking interest of this money. And if you were the first to play this game, then you are getting a large amount of benefits. But if you were the thousands of this game joining this game, then you are getting a small amount of these benefits. So the scale-free degree distribution is giving you an idea of this preferential attachment as well. And the cumulative success of consecutive tasks is also an explanation. So if you are doing a certain task and you are successful, that is having a certain probability. If you have to do two tasks to complete that basic idea or basic task generally, so it has two subtasks one after the other, then the completion successfully these two tasks one after the other is less. But it's not zero probability. If the first task is helping you to complete the second task, then it has a quite high probability that you will complete all. And if you have 100 tasks one after the other, to complete all of them, if the first is helping the other, if the second is helping the third, and so on, it has quite a high probability, not zero probability, and therefore you have a non-zero chance to finish all of them. So this is actually a basic principle of the self-organization of matter in the universe, this cumulative success of consecutive tasks, and this is what is giving you actually the basic idea why scale-free degree distribution is so general in network science. So I was reaching the last slide of this first course, and we reached actually the 1 hour of this course. So see you later, and see you in the next section of our network science course later on.